Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Purport and our interview with John Rappaport 2015, A Free and Inspired Life. John, you're a man who needs no introduction, so let's just dive in.
Okay.
You and I have been discussing A Free and Inspired Life for a long time because it was you who got me to start thinking about it. And but this year was really, I would say for me, it was a watershed. And it all started with the Secret Space program where you stood up and gave an incredible speech about the power of the individual to create their world, is the way I'll say it. And of course, that presentation, that speech is available to subscribers with the Secret Space program videos that are up on the blog. But I would say that something happened there that few days that kind of got us all shifting and thinking in a new way. So maybe you could talk about the conference, your speech, and what you think happened.
Sure. Well, first of all, like all good conferences, some of the best things that happen are offstage, people talking to each other. And in my case, certainly, it was talking with you, with Joseph Farrell, with other people, just to air it out, you know, to sit around and have conversation with highly intelligent, perceptive people who have been at this trough of research and investigation for a long time and sharing ideas. So I think that would be number one on my list. And then to see the enthusiasm of the people who showed up, the attendees, and the discussions with them off stage in between talks, it was a terrific community of shared interest. And then my talk itself, I think the main thing for me was just standing up and looking out at the audience and the space and thinking to myself, how can we in the next hour or so get to another level of consciousness or perception, what have you? Let's forget about whatever I thought I was going to talk about, and let's just do that. You know, that's the challenge for me always when I give public talks, is where do people look like they're coming from? Where am I coming from? How can we collaborate in this short space of time to light a spark that will get people not just to introspect and ruminate, but to find something within themselves that's inspiring, you know, that makes them want to climb out further from the old ways into the new. And so I felt that happen several times during the talk, and I could see people reacting in that way, laughing at times, and it was just that sort of rubbing of surfaces together that produces something that you can't really put a label on, but you know it happened. So that was the thing for me. I felt satisfied after that, that, okay, people are going to go home and they're going to sense that within themselves they have a lot more energy and excitement of possibility. And if they want to pursue that, they're going to take an adventure that's going to be quite fantastic.
Well, after the Secret Space program, I kept talking with you and Joseph saying, how can we nurture the culture that seemed to emerge? And I think it was simply being for a couple of days with a group of people who were very interested in figuring out what reality is and how they could influence in a positive manner, as opposed to just struggling in the oppressive, you know, consensus reality. And trying to navigate it. And so, you know, we decided to do a workshop in November, which happened. in California, and it was a first sort of try to see, because one of the things I heard at the Secret Space Program from everybody is we want to be able to talk to each other. You know, we want to meet each other, we want to talk to each other. And it was one of the things, as you said, that was happening sort of off stage at the conference. So we got together for the conference, but the first thing that happened before the conference is that wonderful Ben Lazzardi said, okay, if we're going to ask people to do a backcasting, which is one of the things that happened, where you, backcasting is the opposite of forecasting. You go into the future and you tell the story of how your dreams came true. And it's a planning technique, which I find very useful. Anyway, Ben said, we have to do it first on the Solari team. So we sat down and I tried to do it. And one of the things I discovered is, despite the inspiration of your speech, I was really stuck in the mud about all the obstacles in the environment. And sort of how difficult the environment was, and the whole team was. We were kind of down in the mud in Miceville and without an inspiring plan to get around the obstacles. And, you know, we didn't want to commit to do a whole lot. And so, I got to the workshop, and that's what I heard from everybody else, that they too were very concerned about the obstacles in the environment and having, you know, having people they could network with and talk to seemed to make that easier. But the other thing they said, John, was that they were really having challenges on a couple of issues. One was figuring out, sorting people. How do you figure out who you're in alignment with and who you're not? How do you make sure you don't let people into your life who drain your energy? So that was number one. The second was, how did they process information? I was astonished during the conversations, particularly during the meals, how many had fallen prey to disinformation. And they were really struggling with how to tell good information from bad. And the last thing was, how do you deal with dysfunctional organizations? You know, more and more their time was being wasted by companies or governments that were just insensitive to the value of their time. And it seemed to be a remarkable chorus of those same issues. How do I get around the obstacle? How do I underwrite people? How do I filter information and get the information that can really help me navigate? And how can I deal with dysfunctional organizations? And so one of the things I was hoping we could talk today about is sort of, you know, everybody's situation is different, but what are some of your key principles on how to do some of those things? Because, you know, it comes back to imagination. I think you need extraordinary imagination to do all three of those, as well as extraordinary faith. And you're the master. You know, when I'm challenged on either imagination or faith, I slap in my John Rappaport CDs and off I go. So where would you like to start? Let's dive in.
Okay. Well, let's start with people, other people, because that is one of the key factors you mentioned. You know, how do you filter other people and join with other people when you want to do something productive without discovering that those people are draining your energy or they are not up to the task or any of the possible downsides. And I think we discussed this in a conference call, you and I and Joseph Farrell. And one of the things that I said was, well, you've got to have a vision of what you want, and you have to step out on that path, a certain
right.
steps on your own, to then be able to look around and see who shows up, because nobody's going to show up if you're invisible. To me, that's the first factor. If you're invisible to everybody else, then you're going to get a lot of static from a lot of people. It's just going to be kind of random, like taking an old radio and just kind of turning the knob from station to station. All sorts of stuff is going to show up, none of which is particularly useful or relevant, but if you, to sort of boil it down and give a kind of simplified image, if you step out from that and you say, this is where I am. This is what I stand for. This is what I am about. This is the future that I want. If you do that in some way that is public, at a local level, online, in some fashion or another, then people are going to show up based on that. Now, that doesn't automatically mean they're the right people, but it does give you a measuring rod, so to speak. Who are these people? What do they have to say? Are they simply trying to hang on to what you're doing because they have nothing better to do, or are they, trying to criticize what you're doing in some way, or would they like to be part of what you're doing, but they don't really have the tools to do it, or, and I would say these are the people in the minority, intelligent, perceptive, creative people show up who have come to similar conclusions that you have, and they want to somehow be connected to what you're doing. And you, of course, have to be able to judge that, but at least you now have a starting point. And then to sort of qualify those people, the good ones who show up, one of my best yardsticks on that has been their persistence. Not yours, but theirs. Do they keep showing up again? Do they have intelligent things to say? Because if they are real, it's not just going to be a one-time thing for them. They're going to see something in you, and they're going to want to connect more than once. They will be persistent. That's how I found the best people to work with. That's my experience. And in fact, the most important person that I'm working with in what I do showed up 4, 5, 6 times. And finally I saw, well, this guy is not only persistent, but he seems to be extremely knowledgeable and talented, and let's have a conversation. And it turned out to be revolutionary in terms of what I do.
Right.
So that's the beginning of it for me.
For me, part of it is just letting things evolve, giving them time. So you kind of walk before you run. And you need to understand, you know, everybody's dealing with, whether it's their family or their business or their community in some way, they're dealing with other obligations to other people. And you know, particularly when it comes down to business, you need to make sure that there's alignment between where their ecosystem is headed and where yours is headed, because otherwise you can end up heading in other directions. So another thing that happened at the workshop that I wanted to bring up was we did an exercise called a wayfinding where we put up a timeline that went 50 years back and 50 years forward. And everyone was invited to first put up down on a post-it note events that they thought were important over the last 50 years and stick them up. And John, I can't tell you, most of the events were negative. And yet this was a crowd of very positive, well-educated people. And one of the things I realized, because we can't find a way to get to the truth of what happened and sort of clear it, we can't clear these things out of our minds and hearts. You know, they're kind of stuck.
Right.
You know, we can't kind of say, okay, well, Kennedy was assassinated and, you know, we wish it hadn't happened, but there it is. You know, it's kind of stuck there looking for a way as a society to clear it. And I really felt, this group is burdened by, you know, we're burdened by the truth here in this way. And then interestingly enough, we hadn't thought a lot about very far out in the future. And if I had to do it over again, I'd make the wayfinding timeline 2,000 years back and 2,000 years forward and see if we couldn't think a little bigger. So, you know, 1,000 years from now, you know, I have grandkids living on 20 different planets.
You know, that
anyway,
is one of the great answers, just what you just said. I mean,
that's
my take. 2,000 years into the future. Okay, so now we're kind of getting to this is a pretty good piece of time here in space. All right, now we got something to look at here. where the things that have happened in the last, say, 50 or 75 or 100 years begin to have less pressing significance, where we have to solve the mystery completely before we move on, you know, which is always sort of a trap, because sometimes you can get close, but you don't have the definitive answer.
Right.
But when you're looking at that kind of time period that you're talking about, and the one that I look at all the time, you know, what's wrong with saying, how about the next 10,000 years? What's that going to be like? You know,
right.
Now let's think about that, you know, because right. Then you open it all up. The space gets bigger. Your imagination gets bigger. Your perception gets sharper. Your ability to add up the past and use it to project different futures, long-term futures. That, to me, now you begin to get information coming through that you wouldn't be able to get any other way. For example, what is at the root of human beings? Because I could easily say the next 50 years, the next 100 years are going to see a much greater limitation on freedom. Let's suppose I started with that idea.
Okay.
You know, we're going to go through forms of society which are much more conformist and organized, hyper-organized, than we see now. Okay. But we're not going to stop there. We're going to say, okay, so what is this going to do to the human being? What is this going to provoke from the core of what human beings are, if this indeed happens? Because that's got to be part of your thinking.
Right.
Now you begin to see, well, you know, there are deep levels of humans that are not going to stand for this
right.
beyond a certain point. What are they going to do? What's everybody going to do? And what will be the result of that? And then what's the fallout from that? And so on and so forth. And you begin to look further and further up ahead the line there, and you begin to see new positive things emerging. And once you do that, you can then come back from that long-term future to the present and say, I'm now better informed, really, about what the human condition is all about. And I can apply some of that to now.
Right, and what you discover is, you know, life is not so easy to lock down.
Exactly. It's not so easy
right.
to lock down. We are much more than we think we are, exactly. In the short term, you bet. And if you're only looking at the short term, then you become extremely depressed. Yeah, everything is going to get worse and locked down and this and that and the other thing. Sure, we can all see those trends happening, but as you say, the human being is not easy to lock down. Things happen, things that
right.
are unpredictable, good things.
Well, I told you the story of in 1998 when I realized what was happening. I couldn't come up with an explanation, whether it was the chemtrails or GMOs or anything else that didn't include depopulation. And I got a call from a money manager in London who said, you know, can I stop in and have lunch with you when I'm in Washington? So we went out to Union Station for a very elegant lunch, and he said very quietly, we're in a table in the corner, he said, I know this sounds very strange, but I've looked at all these different things. He was also a portfolio strategist, and he did this and this and this, and the only logical conclusion I can come to is they're planning on depopulating the population. He said, in fact, I think they're planning on depopulating down to about 500 million people, and I said, that's my number two. And I went home from that lunch, John, and I said, can I be happy? Can I live in a world where that's happening? And can I be happy? And, you know, I had to think about that for a while. It took me a week or so. And I decided, yes, I can be happy. First of all, I have to do everything I possibly humanly can to warn people first. And so that whatever happens is, you know, we're all participating in the creation of what happens. So I have to bring as much transparency as I can to the governance and financial process. So there's, you know, that was part of just being integrity about the whole thing. But the other thing is, you know, I just have to appreciate that I'm one person. I get one 1/7 billionth of a vote in the thing. And, you know, what happens is part of a much higher power. So it was part of coming to terms with approaching the whole thing spiritually, because I realized it's like my friend who came home from her initiation into a Buddhist temple, and she said, she looked very depressed. I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "Oh my God, I've just discovered I'm personally responsible for world peace. How can I possibly be responsible for world peace?" You know, but we're all going to have to live in a world where we accept personal responsibility for the whole. And that's, you know, for people who have never been introduced to that thinking, that's very kind of challenging. And, you know, we're used to not being given responsibility for something that we don't have the authority to deal with.
What I think she was also leaving out of that whole initiation process was, yes, you can view yourself as responsible for the whole, but at the same time, you can say, yeah, but things might turn out otherwise.
Right.
And then you get a certain distance from it. You get a certain, okay, I'm not the person who is doing bad things to everybody. And I think this is part of the reason why people were listing negative events on their chart, because people are not used to the idea that bad things can happen in a way that, you know, is more than they're ordinarily used to. It's like, well, if this bad thing happens, then the whole show's over.
Right.
I got nothing to contribute. I don't know what to do. I'm at a loss. I'm completely depressed. The worst possible thing has come true. The end. You know, that's the story. I just read the story, and at the end it was horrible, and I put the book down, and I curled up in bed and turned out the lights. Well, that isn't the end. It's just another phase.
Right.
There's a lot more to come.
One of another thing I had to come to grips with at that time was realizing, oh, wait a minute, I'm not governed by the government, and I'm not governed by Mr. Global. So what am I governed by? What do I choose to be governed by? And so you have to leave behind those hierarchies that you somehow had the feeling that, you know, somebody was watching out for you. I'll never forget, I recorded 6 tapes for my attorneys on most, you know, 99% of my recollections of working in the Bush administration, call them the Kemp tapes. And people who worked for me started to request, could they listen to them? And they listened to them and come back in a state of terror. And they said, you know, I always had this image that there was a group of people who were like taking care of things. And I didn't understand, oh no, there's just a group of people who are taking, you know, they're using those positions to take what they want. And the thing is quite arbitrary and chaotic, you know, so I think part of this process is coming up with a very different vision in your mind of who's responsible for what, and what are the authorities that you, number one, have to watch out for versus, you know, you truly accept in your heart are part of your governance structure.
Yes, it's a spiritual thing. There's no question
yeah.
about it. You're forced to that level, whether you want to be there or not. I remember a talk that I once gave in front of a small group, and it was on this very subject, and I looked out, and there were about 18 people in the room, and for some reason, they all had in front of them a spread from McDonald's. And they were sitting at little desks. It was kind of almost like a classroom. And they had giant Cokes and, you know, all kinds of cheeseburgers running, dripping over and fries and whatever. And here I am talking about, you know, what's your real spiritual vision of things? And, you know, I thought, wow, this is the joke of the day, you know, that I'm now in an impossible situation. There's no way under the sun that I'm going to be able to talk to these people. So I said, well, look, here's what's going to happen to you in case you're interested. If you're not, that's fine, too. Just keep on sucking on that straw. You're going to be forced into a spiritual position beyond anything that you currently have in the way of conviction. And I don't know what that's going to be for you. I mean, I can't give you a label or a name or a doctrine or something like that. That's up to you. But it isn't going to be about the meal that you're eating now or how much money you're going to make the next 6 months or any of that. You're going to, things are going to happen in this world. They're going to put you in that position where you're going to have to make a decision about what is your highest ideal, and that is always going to lead you into a spiritual realm from which you can become extremely powerful if you want to. But if you don't do that, then, you know, you're just going to slide into a kind of oblivion.
Right. Right, and a very scary and or frustrating oblivion.
Yeah, because that is, in a way, the definition of oblivion. You have no spiritual position on anything. So it's like, okay, I'm lying down in the street, here comes the steamroller, and I'm just going to lie here and let it run over me because that's all I've got. No, that ain't all you got. You got a lot more than that, but you need to access it. And most people only pay lip service to that. But this requires much more than that.
Well, it was really funny. The reason I think everybody's going to be put through this process is the middle of the road is getting squeezed down to nothing. So you're going to have to get on one side of the, you know, it's force on one side of the golden rule. Which model do you want to be a part of? So, but I'll never forget listening to one of John Trudell's tapes, and he was describing the fact that the entire planet has this giant drain associated. And his whole view on this and his whole argument was completely based on spiritual and cultural issues. And yet it matched up entirely with what I describe as the slow burn, which I'm coming to simply from financial, legal, and regulatory issues. So he and I shared not one ounce of sort of our the evidence for arriving at this place, but we arrived at exactly the same place. And I said, yeah, that's what I said. I said, well, I guess it's really true. And that's why I keep saying this whole planet is paying a dividend. We're either paying it into another dimension or we're paying it to another planet. You know, I don't know where this dividend is going, but the whole planet is on a high yield, is on a high yield tax, and it's going someplace.
I think this also, what we're talking about now, is an entree into evaluating information. It gives you something to compare information to, which is your own vision, and that vision gets you into a spiritual realm. You look at information and you can say, well, okay, so this person is predicting the most extreme outcome from whatever information they have or evidence they have, the worst possible thing, you know, which is that every president is actually a lizard, shifting lizard, and at his command, he has the most formidable mind control tools ever devised in this universe. And basically, we're all helpless. We're food for the lizards. And you see this repeated over and over and over and over again in one form or another, in one story or another, where somebody gives you the most extreme position. Or, on the contrary, the other side of the coin gives you an incredible deus ex machina solution that all of a sudden in the next 6 weeks we're all going to become billionaires because we didn't know that we had these accounts, you know, whatever. And somebody's going to show up at the door and say, I know you don't know this, but really you're now worth $6 billion and here's a check and the limo's waiting for you to go to the bank and deposit, you know, or whatever it is, you know, rescue. And so much information that I see people gravitating toward, almost like, you know, iron filings to a magnet, is on one side or the other.
Right.
The worst possible thing is just about to happen, or the best, in the next, right coming up, next week, next month. and they're always wrong, and nobody apologizes. Oh, gee, I'm...
No one ever sits down. It's funny, you know, I'm in business, you're big on lessons learned. You sit down and say, well, why was I wrong? You know, what's the lessons learned here? I was wrong. Why was I wrong? And, you know, I'll never forget after Y2K happened and nothing happened, I figured, okay, we're all going to talk about, well, why was everybody wrong about this? No one wanted to talk about it.
No one wanted to have that conversation, right?
Right. And you get these newsletter writers, you know, and I just have to pick on Jim Rickards because his emails drive me crazy. I can't seem to get rid of them. You know, it's going to crash tomorrow, and then the next day it's going to crash tomorrow, and then the next day,
right.
and a CIA insider says it's going to crash tomorrow. And, well, one of the things that happened at the workshop was I decided to really make an effort with this year's wrap-up, which we published on the 8th, to really present information that would help our subscribers not get tricked by the disinformation. You know, we put up a website called Money Maps, and it's just a simple review of key economic and statistical and geographical information. I'm always stunned at the extent to which most of us don't have a basic grounding in geography. And you know, I'll give you one example at the workshop. It was Joseph. My favorite thing was watching Joseph's face when we had this conversation, but you had various people in the audience who were convinced that the dollar was going to collapse tomorrow and the Chinese were going to, you know, command the reserve currency. And I lost it. I blew up and I said, the Chinese have one aircraft carrier. It's brand new. They're just learning how to sail it. And Joseph's face was just priceless. And we proceeded to try and explain the basic nuts and bolts of what it takes to run, you know, the equivalent of, or to run the actual Bretton Woods system. And, you know, you can't do it with one aircraft carrier and a regional GIS satellite system. It can't be done. It's a, you know, you have to manage global flows. Anyway, it was funny, but I said, you know, we have to have a review in the annual wrap up where we go back and we revisit the basics of high school geography, so that, you know, I can get rid of 50% of these traps that the subscribers are falling into. And I have to tell you, this has been one of the most crowded, you know, I spend a huge amount of time on the wrap up, John, because I need a framework for investment strategy where I can make sense of the huge flow of incoming noise and kind of understand what's important and what's not. And it's critical to setting investment allocations for the year and knowing when to evolve them and when to keep, you know, to stand firm. And so I need a framework. It's my way of checking in and making sure my framework is sound. And so this year I really went to town because I listened to the confusion at the workshop and I said, you know, I can't let this continue. We've got to get out of some of these wackier scenarios. But it's and that's why I think filtering the information is so important, because I really believe if people can get some good maps and understand what's important or not. I mean, I'll give you an example. One of my favorite times this year was during the midterm election, when on one hand, I was watching what I call the Ebola Shriekometer, and it was the number one story in Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal, the business press, and normally, you know, they're used to 5 years ago, the business press didn't play these games. It was the tabloids and then it was the general paper. And now it's the, you know, the business guys. And they're just pushing complete disinformation. And it's complete hogwash. And it's scaring lots of people to death. But your emails are coming in. And you can't, you know, it's so hard for people to fathom that. You know, that Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal would promote this much complete non-reality. And yet, you know, because I've read, I think, almost everything, if not everything you've ever done, you know, I know that your knowledge on this is totally deep and you're knocking out these emails that just slice into shreds. And had, you know, me and the people I was staying, we were all, you know, we couldn't wait for the next John Rappaport email, at which point we could laugh, you know, I could laugh about it. So, you know, so the information's there And it's even there in entertaining, you know, forms that get you to laugh. But you got to find it. And so I think the most important thing a person can do is find regular sources of information that help them filter and understand what's important and what's not important and what's real and what's not real. Because the uncertainty in the environment is great. And I think 2015 is going to be much more challenging this way in 2015 because we're than 2014, because we really are seeing the global order unravel. So we're watching a great unraveling, and the G7 is going into the, you know, into the what's called the demographic winter, and so the immigration is going to accelerate. And so the change that those two things alone, as well as new technology, is going to bring around a lot of change, and a lot of assets are going to be flying around. And as I say, 2.0 is going to be disintegrating and 3.0 is going to be rising. But the cards are constantly going to get reshuffled. And unless you have a picture of you know, why that's happening and where things are going and where you want to be and where you don't want to be, it's going to be intolerable, I would think.
Oh, completely. Completely. Because then you feel that you're at the mercy of this. It's like I'm out in a rowboat in the middle of the Atlantic in winter, and here comes another wave this way, and the wind is blowing that way, and how can I make up my mind about anything, you know, aside from trying to survive? Because you feel like everything is closing in, and there's no way out. And that's the primary illusion. That's
right.
The illusion that in which the individual is totally discounted and the individual's vision is totally discounted. You're just another cipher on the board, another piece of, on the, you know, huge chessboard that's being moved around by outside forces, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, one of the things that I noticed during this whole Ebola scam that repeats each time one of these phony epidemics is launched is the incredible exaggeration of numbers. And I'm sure this occurs in the money sphere as well, and in every sphere. Somebody will say, well, Dr. So-and-so of the credential says that by Christmas, it's quite possible we'll have 1 million cases of Ebola. You know, so I look at this. Right? And I think, wow. You know, these people are just ridiculous, you know, 1 million cases, wow. Because this was the same tactic that was used during the swine flu.
Right.
When the CDC said, actually, in retrospect, now that we look back on it, there were 10 million cases of swine flu in the United States. 10 million cases of swine flu in the United States, right?
Except you and I didn't know anybody who had it.
No, not one person, right?
And they were all in North Dakota.
Yeah, somehow. They must have all moved to North Dakota and gotten sick. I don't know what happened. But so that's the sort of thing, you know, the extreme, extreme, extreme. And sometimes it comes from, you know, quite often from official sources. And then you have these other sources, you know, like the guy you mentioned. The world is crashing tomorrow. You know, the dollar is gone tomorrow. Well, it didn't happen, so it's happening tomorrow. I mean, I meant actually tomorrow, you know. And they keep moving the goalposts back and back and back and back and back. You know, you begin to see you have to see these patterns emerge, and then you know,
right.
Well, I've seen this. Wait a minute, I've seen this before, not just once, but 5, 10 times. Never came true. So that's called a clue. It's not going to happen this time either. And look at what they're doing. Now you begin to see what they're actually doing with these extremes. Oh, I see. Okay, so they're promoting fear. And what's the payoff? What do they envision the payoff is? You know, and it depends on who's doing it and what their payoff is. But there's always a payoff, and it has nothing to do with what they're talking about.
My favorite of the newsletters that say, you know, the global market's crashing, everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket. But you, and the way to deal with it is you buy the stock. And I'm like, wait a minute, if the global financial market crashes, you know, that stock certificate's going to disappear. It's digital, you know. What do you mean buy a stock? Anyway, so it's, well, one of the things I wanted to bring up was your imagination exercises, because the thing that helps me, I can know that something is completely ludicrous and absurd, but the thing that helps me the most is saying, okay, well, what can I do about it? Where is the pathway? How do I create a pathway? I'll never forget my favorite time at the Secret Space Program, bar none. You and I are sitting on a panel with Joseph and Richard Dolan, and some guy gets up to the microphone and says, well, you know, blah, 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 and what are we going to do about this? And you turned to him and he said, no, pal, what are you going to do about this? And the people up here on the panel have been doing plenty for years. What are you going to do? And the look on his face was, I wanted to go down to him and say, you need to get John's imagination exercises, because in fact, you can do something about this. You do have the power to do something about this. And that's
are based on the idea that we tend to accept, quote, reality as it is, as being, well, this is it. You know, what else do you want? Here it is. And if you do that, if that's your initial premise, that's like opening up a feeding tube, you know, into your mind from the press, the media, the politicians, the bankers, the liars, you know, the propagandists, and you're just kind of lying there and letting it all come in, because that's reality. You know, that's the way it is, supposedly.
All right.
Whereas all these exercises that I give people to do with imagination is based on the fact that that's not true, that you can imagine other realities. And at first, some people have a little bit of a problem with that, because they have learned or been taught that imagination is just a toy for children, and, you know, once you're an adult, it's all over. But in fact, when people do these every day for a few minutes, they begin to get the idea eventually, wow, wait a minute, you know, I've actually, my view of reality as it is, quote, that's another piece of imagination, you know, that I've been fooling myself with here, because I'm imagining all sorts of other things, and I realize now that I have options that I've never seen before, that
right.
I wouldn't know about before, because where do options come from? They come from conceiving of other possibilities, imagining other things, and it's contagious. It's contagious within your own mind, within your own perception. You begin to see things differently now. Many things become much more, shall we say, provisional, that you thought were embedded in concrete forever. And now you see that you have possibilities. I can do this, I can do that. There's all sorts of things I can do. And that's what imagination, actually, your imagination, not mine, teaches you, that you have all these possibilities. So, yeah, for that person in that audience who said, you know, what are we going to do about it, you know, he was essentially confessing, well, I don't know anything about my own imagination, so I need you to tell me. No,
right.
You don't.
I keep a copy of one of the first sets that I ever got from you next to my bed. And I just have to tell this story, although I know you've heard it many times, is one of my favorites is when I drive down the road, you know, I do a lot of interstate driving. I decorate all the trees I pass with precious gems. And it's a couple times I've done it for many hours. And I can't tell you how powerful it feels. You know, you arrive and you say, well, I've just, you know, spread $50 billion worth of diamonds and pearls across the entire East Coast. I'm very powerful. One of my other favorite ones is where you basically stretch energetically to all the different places on the world. And sometimes when I'm finalizing my travel schedule, I think, well, you know, let me just go to Buenos Aires and London energetically one more time and make up my mind where I want to go. And it's funny, because what I've learned is, you know, just as we believe we should exercise our bodies, we need to exercise our imagination, because if you don't, you lose it. And I'm always struck when I do the exercises, how much more, you know, I always say, oh my God, I was really stuck in Miceville. You know, I need to remember to do this, because there's something about the environment right now that is causing people to, you know, you're encouraged to think smaller and smaller and smaller. So one of the, there were two other points I wanted to bring up. One was, I'm someone who really feels I get a lot more accomplished if I am in a state of coherence. And yet I find, you know, sometimes one of the reasons I run and live in a rural area is, you know, I find the cows and the trees very coherent. And I live in a place where there's not a lot of people and there's certainly not a lot of corporate media and they don't want to come here. So, you know, and I don't own a television. And so my life is very stripped and void of things that, that introduce coherence. And I have a, you know, I have a pattern of if something's bringing incoherence into my life, I just delete it. So I think, you know, another question I have is, what's our advice to how to help people stay in a state of coherence when the general population in society, from my standpoint, is achieving higher and higher levels of incoherence?
Well, yeah. I mean, first is to notice that, you know, that people are spinning out of, you know, their center into all kinds of distractions here, everywhere, you know. And the other thing is that you don't have to do that. It's not imperative that you follow along with that, because you can get into a conversation with people where under the surface what they're really saying is things are becoming so weird that I don't even know what's going on and I have no idea what to do. They're not saying that, but if you look below the surface of the conversation, that's what it means. And it's repeated right over and over again, like some sort of a hypnotic command. So to remove yourself from that physically, but also really in an inner way, that you're not buying that. Yes, they're not entirely wrong about what's going on out there, but the interpretation of what it means for you is entirely wrong. You don't have to be coming from that place. You can come from another place entirely, which then throws everything into the right perspective. Now you're looking from, you know, a kind of a still point out to this madness, and you're able to see it for what it is, as opposed to being part of it. That's
right.
That's the thing you want to exit from.
Whenever I go into your office and see your paintings, I think, oh, that must be how he does it. The calligraphy is so beautiful. A second thing is, how do you, you know, I said to the Solari team, look, here's our business plan for 2015. We have fun. That's it. Because if we can have fun, that's the pathway. You know, you're on the pathway if you're having fun. And I think the question is, how can you have fun when this much bad stuff is happening to this many people? And why is it important that each one of, you know, to me, each one of us who can have a free, inspired life increases the chance that everybody else can. So how do you sit down and really enjoy your life, you know, create all sorts of things that give you pleasure when the world around you is in a state of unhappiness or fear? How do you do that? And how can we know that it's okay to do that?
Well, I've told this story before, but in a nutshell, a friend of mine 25, 30 years ago, who was a very well-known athlete, I mean, a very capable person, she's slowly driving down the street near her house, and some kid runs out from nowhere, and she hits him with her car.
Mm.
Kid falls down the street. She immediately gets out of the car. And there's all kinds of people that, you know, show up out of their houses and, oh, my God, what do we do? You know, it's just all madness and chaos and confusion and emoting and whatever. She walks over to the kid, kneels down, takes a look at him, says to somebody, you know, call, you know, 911, whatever it was then, tends to this boy, sees that he's basically okay, assures him that he's going to be okay. And he is okay. Now, years later, I have a conversation with her. She brings it up. I mean, I don't know this story from anything. She says, you know, I've always been confused about that moment. She said, because I've always thought that maybe, you know, there was something cold about me. There was something that didn't care. I said, what are you talking about? I said, you were the only one who dealt with the actual situation. Everybody else was flipped out. Now, they might call that human sympathy, empathy, whatever. I don't care what they call it. But the fact of the matter is that only you were able to assure this kid that he was okay and he believed you and he calmed down, right? She said, yeah, that's exactly what happened. I said, so who's the hero? You know, face up to it. Which means that if you can, you know, keep your head while others are losing theirs, then you're in a position to actually do something and actually enjoy yourself while being alive in the process. It's not your fault that other things are happening to other people all the time.
Right.
I mean, people have to keep this in mind. You don't have to fall into a total state of despair. You can be happy. You can see what's going on and you can do something about it. And often you'll find that you're the only one who can do something about it because you're not totally embroiled in the whole thing emotionally.
You know, one of the great moments for me was in 1998 when I was in the maximum pain of, you know, dealing with physical harassment and subpoenas and investigations and just, you know, somebody was coming at me from every side. They were following me in the car. They were following my house guests. It was unbelievably immersive. And I was at church and the pastor had on a whole head of steam and he said, I guess it was the co-pastor. And she said, honey, you can have my house. You can have my car. You can have my job, but you cannot have my joy. That's when I realized, oh yeah. The joy, I get to decide the joy one. Nobody can take that away from me. If I decide, I'm going to have joy. And it was really interesting. At that point, we created a list called the Soleri Beauty List. And it was everything that gave us pleasure that didn't cost any money. And we would literally, whenever anything got bad, we'd take out the list and then we'd do something on the list. It was kind of funny. Anyway, so...
Great. I mean,
it did work.
This is what you're bringing up to me is fantastically important. Having fun in a world where it looks like, you know, far too few people are having fun, just the opposite. People try to persuade us that that's not okay. Oh, no, you can't do that. No. But that's, being able to do that is, among other things, I mean, you're entitled, as you say, to, you know, you're the one who decides
right.
That issue. Am I going to have joy or not? Nobody else does. And plus, if you are having joy and fun, you are far more capable of dealing with any situation that comes your way where other people are not having fun to improve that situation. If you're in there with them at their level, you're cooked.
What you read in global surveys is that in places where people's conditions are improving, so where their GDP per capita is going up, people report higher levels of happiness and satisfaction. And where it's going down, you know, it's the opposite. So in America, you see things going down, and in the emerging markets, where the middle class is growing, you see things going up. And, you know, the subscribers and clients and network that I have that are traveling around the world often report that there are other places where people seem to be much more happy. And they also, you know, America individuals are very, there's a lot of alienation and a lot of divide and conquer. And there's societies where there's much less effort to promote divide and conquer. And the reports are people seem to be happier.
But, I have no doubt about that.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And what they're happy about is...
are little things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A traveler would have to stop and take a look for a while to even figure out what that is. You know, I see people who say they seem to be enjoying themselves. You know, wow, what a crime. So what is it that they've got? I mean, is there some giant bag of sugar that they're all hiding that they go to during the day and they unload it and they start eating sugar? I mean, is it, what is it, you know? And you look around, you don't see what it is. Where is it? What's happening? Well, as you say, it's the little things. It's being alive. They figured that out. Being alive is fun.
One of the, in the wrap up, one of the sections is I walked through the 12 most important stories and trends. And the stories that were important were chosen because they really, you know, brought out a deeper trend. One of the trends that I chose was called uncivil society, because I'm experiencing and noticing just an explosion in bad behavior in the United States. Part of it's the media, but, you know, I'm seeing it. You certainly see it online. There's some radio shows that I do, and then you read the comments, and everybody's having a competition to see who can be meaner and more, I don't know, it's a very... Joseph gave a great presentation at the workshop about the jungle beat versus the harpsichord music. You know, are we going to live our lives on one track or 28? You know, Bach lived on 28 and the jungle beat lives on one. And these are very sort of one track kinds of thinking. There's no depth to the, you know, it's kind of mob thinking. Anyway, but I read an article in Wired magazine about 2 months ago that was totally depressing. It indicated that online, the meaner you were, the smarter people thought you were. I thought, oh, that's, you know, we have to go through this phase until everybody discovers, oh, meanness does not necessarily equate with intelligence.
Yeah.
But there it is.
It comes back to, I think, what we were just talking about. You know, why is a person being that way? Because they see no out. They see no escape. They feel like, you know, they're trapped because they don't know how to live a free and inspired life, which has really nothing to do with some magical bank account that appears out of nowhere. Not really. It has to do with something that happens inside themselves.
Right.
And if this is a society where what happens inside yourself is devalued more and more and more and more and more, then that's exactly the kind of behavior you're going to get.
Well, one of the reasons it helped me to do the wrap up, and I described this in the introduction at sort of the end of the introduction, I go through the big trends that are happening right now from the financial point of view. One being that the Bretton Woods system is unraveling. The second is that we are emerging, much more powerful global equity markets, and we're in the process of building out the infrastructure for the global currency, and that, you know, that translates into thousands of news stories that you don't necessarily sort of aggregate and see that those are the deeper trends. And what I come back to is all year long, and this is one of the most frustrating parts of 2014 for me, I bounce back and forth between two groups. One says, oh, you know, you can't really understand the system. Just throw your money in index funds and trust the establishment. They will see you through. And I, you know, I'm kind of thinking, well, that didn't work too well in 2008. You know, it worked last year and this year, but, you know, I don't think that's a lifelong plan. And then you have another group of people who are absolutely insistent, and the gold bugs are a group like this. You know, they have their model. They don't want to hear any evidence or facts that proves to you, you know, to them that the model no longer fits reality. If you try and bring up the black budget, they completely shut down. They don't want to know. If you tried to warn them about surveillance until Snowden, they didn't want to know. You know, they just didn't, you know, they hadn't kept current with technology. And so you've got this whole world of people who've got an outdated model, and they keep telling you that the market doesn't match fundamentals. Well, the market doesn't match fundamentals of the official reality, you know, but the market by definition matches the fundamentals of reality because, you know, it's happening.
Yeah.
So maybe your official reality is not reality. Maybe you need to rethink reality. But to do that, John, you have to, you know, and it took me till the end of the year to realize, look, I don't want to be a dependent and I don't want to be a victim because they're so cranky. You know, it's just cranky, cranky, cranky. So I don't want to be a dependent. I don't want to be a victim. I want to be free and inspired. But that means I have to look reality square in the face. And I have to use that intelligence to build wealth, whether it's, you know, the wealth that comes from using my time well or taking care of my health or managing my money, blah, 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 blah. But I can do that because I can invent a pathway. I don't need, you know, they have worn pathways. You know, they have trails. But I don't want to be on their trails because I don't agree. I don't think it leads to a free and inspired place. But I can, you know, I don't have to go either way. There's a third choice. There's another choice. And I think that's true for every one of us. We don't have to follow other people's models. We can make our own way.
I believe that to the core.
Right.
When I, you know, 2001, I guess it was, when I started No More Fake News, up until that time, I had been working with and for a publisher in San Diego who went out of business. And so I said, okay, I guess it is time to start a website. And I kicked around with my wife for a while and came up with an idea. And I didn't really know what it was going to be or where I would take it or anything like that. But what I discovered over the years was, yes, there are people out there that are interested in this, you know, whatever I'm writing. What a thought, you know. It was a path, in other words, as you say, that was not the well-worn path. This was not the official reality path to take. You know, I could have become a news person in a more traditional way and probably, you know, made more of a financial success, at least for a while losing my health completely. But I decided, okay, this is a path. Wow.
Right.
Who knew? And it actually works. You know, it actually works. So
right.
That's even a bigger surprise. And that's what I think is in store for everybody that finds that for themselves, where they say, gee, well, this is not the path that everybody else is walking, but it makes sense to me. It's real, very real to me, so let's try it. And then you find out, wow, it works. There are people who respond. Amazing. As if they've been waiting for this to happen, and then they say,
right.
Well, finally somebody, you know, is doing what I was thinking about. So it's a real revelation, that's all I can say.
One of the one of my favorite composers is Curtis Mayfield, and he's got a great line. I think it's from People Get Ready. He's got a great line. He says, "You don't need a ticket. You just get on board."
Right.
And I think I grappled a lot with the economics of how do we organize, how do we, because money requires that you pull up in a variety of different ways. But I've also watched every effort of the what I call the pro-centralization team to control people through different legal or financial mechanisms. And one of the things I've realized, whatever happens, what we need to do first and foremost is we need something to happen in terms of consciousness or energetics, which is completely out of control. There's no movement. There's no staff. There's no card. There's no, you know, we just do it. And we network and we act together as we, you know, and all the financial stuff can happen after that happens. And it can, you know, it can be very particular to all sorts of different things. You know, markets develop from that change in consciousness. But what we don't need, you know, there's a lot of discussion around the workshop. We don't need to be a thing. We each just need to decide, okay, we're going to live a free and inspired life. And we're going to try and, you know, help each other do that, whatever that means to you, wherever you are. And, you know, so we don't need a, you know, what needs to happen is a spiritual and cultural phenomena.
Right.
It's not an organization.
Right.
And, you know, I almost think of, you know, I love, used to have a friend who went to AA meetings and she'd take me along. And I used to always be amazed that AA is one of the most powerful groups in the world, except there is no group. People just meet if they want to, mm-hmm. or not. You know, it's just, you know, it's kind of, it's completely and utterly out of control.
Yes, that's true. I was astonished to find I was assigned an article in the early 80s by the LA Weekly I was writing for. They said, we want you to look into these very high-priced drug rehab centers, elite centers, and see what's going on in the LA area, you know. So, you know, I did interviews and I talked to people and whatever, and I discovered that, you know, basically they were charging people, I don't know, 12, 14 grand a month to live and eat food and go to AA. When it was all said and done, that's what I came out with. I said, well, gee, you know, and I wrote it up. I said, it seems like this is the one thing they have in common. They have this big outer shell of money and this and that, and, you know, but as far as the rehab element, oh, yeah, we have an AA meeting here, sure. And I said, oh, great. I said, anything else? No, that's it.
Maybe we just need to all go to AA to cope with our culture.
Yeah. Culture Anonymous.
So just mention one more time, John, how we can get your imagination exercises or any of your other materials that you can think would help a person. You know, I know you and Joseph and I did the Salieri Report on how to live a free and inspired life, and that's there. And the presentations we prepared for the workshop is also available now to all subscribers. But just describe other materials they can get at your website that I think would be very helpful as well.
Sure. NoMoreFakeNews.com is the website, and you'll see there links for The Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, Power Outside the Matrix. The last two especially have many imagination exercises and descriptions of how to do them. Very simple, straightforward. And there you will also get a lot of background on why. But you do the exercises and you can, you know, with those materials, you'll be exposed to exactly what all these exercises are, and you pick and choose from them yourself so that you're doing something you enjoy doing. It's not meant to be a hardship or some kind of, you know, horrendous sacrifice. It's all enjoyable. That's the whole idea, that you're having fun while you're doing it.
Right.
So that's what I would recommend to people.
Well, I have to say, John, you have provided enormous insight and inspiration to me and everyone in the Salieri Report network, our readers, our subscribers. And so whatever we can do to support you during 2015 to have a free and inspired life, I hope you will let me know.
And please, because I feel exactly the same way. You've been an enormous inspiration to me. And so let's just keep going together here.
I feel like I walk through life telling John Rappaport, the money says you're right. The money says you're right. You have a great day.
You too. Thanks so much.